Good evening. Welcome home, Jeffrey.
Well,
so good to be home.
You're sorely missed.
And thank you for all your kind words. I received a beautiful card in the mail. Thank you for signing that. It kept me warm.
Good. Good. I think you needed it.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, we've been galloping through this little book so far that we're getting very close to the end. unless we want to attach the appendix, 46 ways in which a bodhisattva fails, but I think we should skip that unless you all are eager to explore that. One of them is angrily refusing gifts. It's a big no-no. So I think we've had wonderful instruction in this. I feel like I've learned a lot from it. I'm very grateful to it. So I want to encourage you to think about what there is out there. You can look online at Shambhala, for instance, and see what's published and what looks interesting. And I've got a couple of suggestions that might be interesting to study. So maybe I'll tell you now just so that you can keep that and take it home with you. One is Vasubandhu, who is a very ancient teacher that might be useful for us. It's very different from this. It's Dharma as she is spoke from the ancient times. Another one is The Grass Hut, which is a poem that was written by the one who also wrote Sandokai and who is one of the founders of the Soto Zen school, Chinese. There's a new book out with The Grass Hut and a commentary that goes with it that's very modern and very much about our daily practice. So that's a good one. And then Nagarjuna, which is even more ancient and very, very interesting, and on which much of our practice is based. So there are several books of Nagarjuna. I'll look into it and see which ones would make sense for us to study. But those are three, and there are lots more out there, that, including infinite amount of Dogen. So check it out. I think we have come to the 45th one. Our homework was taking on the three principal causes, having a good teacher, applying a mind and attitude to the Dharma, have the means to be comfortable, or as one of the other commentators said, it's one is the importance of Sangha, because there's no Sangha if there's no teacher, and they're the same. It's actually absolutely the same, and Dharma is part of those two. So we say Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. We mean the teaching, the teacher, and the community. not the teachees so much, because it's not really teaching. It's creating the space, and then the ones who join the space. Or in our tradition, Kogan always said, all members, all things are members of our Sangha. You know, everything. So, keeping that as sort of open dialogue with the Sangha, being awake to being a part of everything, and then taming the mind and realizing that we have everything that we need right now, right here. And then to delight in this, to take joy in these three. It's all we need. Dilgo Khyentse said, equipped with a good horse for an uphill journey, we have all we need. So it's an uphill journey, surely, but we have a great horse. So this was our so-called practice this week. And I don't know what it was for you, but I would be curious to hear.
I just had a small finding, I guess, from the second part where he talks about how easy it is to get all wrapped up in ambition and other projects. And I know you've talked about that recently. I know a couple of times I think we were talking about achievement, and you said, you know, just carry on. Don't get all wrapped up in I did this, and it seems to me a similar point here, that instead of getting all, I guess, distracted really by big ambitions,
mm-hmm.
to just kind of stay with our life and practice in a simple way,
and be satisfied.
With
yeah,
that. And I find that. Find that I get start to get carried away by I'm going to do and it's easier. I mean, I'm retired now. I don't have as many demands on me as, you know, I mean, Marie didn't even get to have dinner tonight to get here, and I mean, So it's easier now for me to let some of those big ambitions go, because my life is very rich and in its own quiet way. But it's still very tempting. There's so many things out in the world and so many people doing really interesting things too, that I think it's kind of a constant challenge to just say. Well, and it's also not that, I don't think he's saying don't try to do anything.
Not at all. But be careful what you choose to do, and don't try to do more than you're able to do, because then it just gets to be a mess.
And it gets to be really crazy.
Yeah, excellent point. That is what it is.
Yeah. I did have a thought. I've been very fortunate in finding good teachers. How does one know if one is associated with a bad teacher?
There have been some irresponsible teachers, for sure. There are some irresponsible teachers, for sure. And then it's important to be gone from there.
If they appeal to your vanity,
yes,
it might be you think they're doing good.
Yes.
How do you know that you're not being led astray?
With your own intelligence and your own wisdom. It's the only measure that we have. If someone is bragging about his enlightened state and his ability to charm and enlighten everybody, that's all very bad stuff and terribly misleading. So it's important to be careful. And then to be careful enough to leave. At one meeting many years ago, a woman was talking about her Tibetan teacher who became abusive. And she decided that she couldn't take it, that it was just too much for her. And she told him she was sorry, but she was going. And he said, "You can't go. You will burn in hell for the rest of your existence if you go." And so when she brought this up in a group, she said, "What shall I do?" She said, "Now I really believe this." He was so sure, and he was my teacher for so long, that she was imbued with this feeling that she was going to burn forever if she left him. But she did leave. And she got a lot of support for it, of course. She was brave enough to bring it up and share it. So it took the badness out of it. But it's tempting for some people, I think. There's a kind of... I mean, in my early years at Jikoji, I decided it would be fun for us all to do Kinhin outside, which we hadn't been doing before. And I was very new at leading sits at all, much less Sesshin. So I was the leader, and I just led everybody out, and then I walked all around the trails and things, and everybody came right behind me like little sheep, and I thought, "Oh my word, they would go anywhere that I made them go. They would just follow me into the pond." You know, it was a terrifying feeling, but I could feel how, boy, that would be fun. You could really jack it up and make something powerful and great for yourself out of persuading people to do what you want them to do. It was a very good lesson. And it showed me clearly what I thought I was trying to do, which was the opposite, to help us all be free, free of any kind of compulsion, much less being compelled by anybody else.
Angie, I wanted to talk about my experience, because I'm about 3 weeks behind where we're at with this, so if you'll bear with me. So the last time I was here was the occasion of my birthday, and we had talked about indeterminacy and how things can change on a dime, and that's exactly what happened to me that very evening. I went to bed, and when I woke up about 2.5 hours later, and I had this severe abdominal pain, and eventually all this led to my gallbladder coming out, and I have been recuperating since, and I've missed all of you immensely. But the point I really want to get to is the training and how I accepted this, vis-a-vis everything we've talked about. And so, because when the rubber hits the road, that's when you find out what this is really all about.
Yeah.
And so I went to Kaiser. That's where I had my operation. And I was treated like the baby Buddha. And everybody were little bodhisattvas all around. I had my treatment was just simply amazing. And I know it was clearly the mind that I established when I went. And was I never meditated so many times in little 15-second and 30-second moments, just to try to position myself in the moment, because there's just a lot of stuff going on in that situation, and so you're constantly being distracted by one thing or another. Talk about the bells and whistles. Emergency rooms are just full of them, but I found some of the most amazing experiences from the fellow who pushed me around on the gurney from, you know, to where I was having MRIs and CAT scans and all kinds of things as they were trying to determine what was wrong with me. But this one young man had been forewarned by my wife. He had asked my wife if the MRI machine, whether I was claustrophobic, and she said, oh, he meditates. He won't have any problem with it at all. Well, the young man was interested in meditation, so as he's pushing me down the hallways, he's asking me all these questions about meditation. It was like, there I am, just sprawled out here, and we're just talking about meditation. It was just this wonderful moment. And in fact, that moment was clearly informing me about where I was, and I wouldn't be having that conversation with a young man had I not been a meditator, and I'd have this teaching. So when I talked to my anesthesiologist, who looked me in the eyes, we were just like that, and he so clearly articulated all the things that were going to happen to me in the next couple of hours. And his professional as well as his heartfelt concern for me was so obvious, and I was so just like, wow, I am in such good hands, such lovely hands, because when you go to the emergency room, you don't know anybody. There isn't anybody there that you are connected with, and yet they make this connection with you, and it had to do with being open. Just remaining really open to what was happening to me during this experience. I tried very hard not, and actually it wasn't difficult. I just, you know, everybody else was anxious. My wife was anxious. Yeah. Wouldn't let everybody else be anxious. I'm not going to be anxious. But I do know that when they went to put that mask over my face, I had a silent gassho. I didn't know, you know, it registered to me that there could be an accident during the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, thank you. And, of course, I woke up.
Hallelujah.
I was surprised.
Peerless surgery. And I was, you know, and once again, it was an opportunity to express my gratefulness to all these complete strangers who did this wonderful job. Because as, you know, as wonderful as you think you are, you can't operate on yourself. You can't dislodge your gallbladder. And I was just, it was that wonderful connection with all things, and as sometimes as cold as you think of a hospital, I tried not to give that. It was like, I'm home. Well, all these people who are really caring for me. My RN was unbelievable. She was this Filipina woman, and she was so concerned about me, and the way she would enter the room so respectfully and in a voice just so beautifully modulated to my needs, right? Because I'm just coming out of surgery, I'm in pain, I'm heavily doped up, all those kinds of things. And she was just wonderful. Yeah. So I spent 2 days in the hospital and then got home. But I have to say, it was like, thank you, Kaiser. Emergency room, you know. They were just wonderful. Anyway, my recuperation and recovery has gone really well. And sometime in the future, I'll be able to once again lift these chairs and open up. So I'm looking forward to that. But,
not yet.
The things about impermanence and keeping an open heart, mind, and following the nuances of the next moment, because mm-hmm. it's just always changing. I just know that without this practice, I would just not be there for that. And the gratitude to the practices, to all the teachers who have taught me, beginning with you, and all my fellow Sangha members mm-hmm. who teach me all the time, and Norman Fisher, whom I've been picking up and rereading it again. Mm-hmm. I first encountered Norman in the late 80s when he and Gary Snyder came to San Jose mm-hmm. and read poetry. And I had gone there to see Gary Snyder, who I, like when I was about 18 or 19, had been reading him. And Norman was new. He was a young Zen priest poet slash poet. Mm-hmm. And I was really taken by him. And I just find his words to be extremely on the mark. I get it.
You know, I agree.
And it's very deep. But he says it in this pretty, you know, mm-hmm. simplistic. It's simple. It's not hard to grasp. So, okay, I'm all through. Thank you. So good to be back.
Thank you. Well, after that, those three, when we have overcome the kleshas and right, Karen? Sure.
Yeah, that was easy. Nothing to it.
So number 46 is to pay heed to the three that never wane, or the three that must not deteriorate. And those three are your devotion to your spiritual friend, which means everyone, and your delightful attitude toward Lojong, or the taming of your mind. Don't let that wane. And the third one is your conduct vows that you have taken, your practice should not diminish. So as Chogyam says, this slogan is straight and low-key. At this point in practicing Mahayana, it's very necessary for us to pick up some basic strength. We're not just careless, carefree people, but our attitude is one of having basic strength, basic energy. Which doesn't mean that we can't go to the movies and have a good time, but to stay focused on our practice, as you said, as much as we can. Just keep returning over and over to where we are and why. Kinsey says, we should live like keeping a garden, keeping it neat, and not lose track. Just keep noticing. Just keep cultivating, keep nourishing. Just live the whole thing as we go along, and don't let it slip. So then the next ones all say just about the same thing. I thought we could maybe put the next three, maybe we should practice to number 50. Keep the three inseparables. So it's a reminder, all of these, to remember what these things are. Inseparable from Lojong. Train without bias in all areas. Always do this pervasively and wholeheartedly. Always meditate on whatever provokes resentment. Always meditate on what's most difficult. So this is a reprise of what we've been through before. And don't be swayed by external circumstances. So let's go that far. And then it's 59 points, so if we get to 50, then we can decide how to do the last ones as well. Other questions?
Is there really such a thing as external circumstances?
No. But we pretend. Wendy?
And what is the spiritual friend that's referenced? Kalyanamitra.
That means spiritual friend, Kalyanamitra. And on the Wednesday group, they have Kalyanamitra meetings where they especially focus on each other, the Sangha, and cultivate the Sangha spirit. We've never done that, but we could. It's about Sangha. Anything else?
Actually, yes, kind of tying in with that question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I was listening to an Upaya talk that was given by this recently transmitted sensei.
Mm.
And His name is Shinzon Palma. He's Hispanic. And so you had to really lean into it to listen, because he has a very... his accent is kind of hard to follow. But the sincerity was just pretty unbelievable, how he talked. But what he talked about was relationship. And he talked about the importance of this relationship that we have with each other, how important it is.
Yes.
And it clearly, for me, the last 3 weeks being away from the group, I thought what an invaluable lesson it was teaching me about how important it is for me to gather with you all at least once a week, because I sure miss you after just that week. And it's all based on this idea of relationship, and that everything is about relationship.
Yes.
You know, how I relate to this earth, this planet, all those folks outside this group. Yes, how we make that relationship with all things. So the spiritual friend, it just really makes a whole lot of sense to me.
It makes all the difference.
Yeah. I just wanted to share.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm new here. I haven't been to too many meetings, but I do want to add that I have been meditating for a while on my own, but it's amazing actually coming here and being with everybody. I don't know many people by names, but it's just wonderful to be here. Mm-hmm. And I just feel, I was talking about this to my daughter, and many of you met her. She was 14 years old, and she was here a couple of times. She couldn't come today because she had a lot of homework. But she was really, really amazed that she could relate to everybody. And many of the things we were talking exist in her teenage world, and she was so surprised by it. And so, yeah, thank you to everyone that, you know, I feel like I can carry this, you know, being present a lot longer in the week. And I really look forward to coming. So thank you to everyone.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, we can feel you.
And
your daughter. What a sweetheart she is. Yeah. Yeah. We all bring that same feeling into the space, and then we can rest in it. Oh, thank you. There's a slogan in the early part of this book that says, if you get up from your cushion and get up from sitting, be a child of illusion. Do you remember that one? And that's the answer to your question, because in terms of the whole of Zazen mind, everything is already there. And so when we stand up, we can get very spacey and sort of start floating around and thinking everything is kind of strange. But that isn't the point. The point is, when we get up, is to be right here, right now, wherever we are. And if it's an illusion, still, it's something we are as we are. So we make the most of it and find some joy in it. Even though we can see through it, in a sense, and need to in order to stay balanced. So, yeah. Well, it's 8:00.